It's time for Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for 3 years has shared with us her decades' research into political assassinations and abuses of power in this country. Her program relates the news of the week to emerging evidence about the conspiracy which allegedly maintains by force its control over the legislative and judicial processes in America. And now, here's Mae.
Good afternoon. This is Mae Brussel, Dialogue Conspiracy number 196, and we're in Carmel, California. It's a beautiful day, April the 12th, 1975. I do have a few announcements before we get on to the main part of the program, the show today. I will be speaking in Sacramento again on the May 23rd. That's a week from this Friday. It'll be at 12 o'clock at the American River College. I was up there a few weeks ago at Consumnes River College and had a very receptive, wonderful audience, and now I'm going back to Sacramento to American River College, Friday, May 23rd. That's at 4700 College Oak Drive. If you wish to attend, it's at 12 o'clock, 12 to 2 or 12 to 4 at American River College. There will be another conference on conspiracies and assassinations at UCLA this next week. I will describe it, even though these tapes go east to places where it's too late to attend the conference. I want to give you a list of what the program is about and who is there, and we'll go into that in 1 second. I do have a new address where you can buy Farewell America or Philip Agee's new book, Inside the Company, or order the Realist articles if you want them or other books. Write to me in care of KLRB, and I will send a self-addressed envelope stamped, and I'll give you information on these books that are available. We also are now able to make copies of Dialogue Conspiracy on tape cassettes. If you want cassettes, 45-minute program, they're $3.60 a cassette. Send the money and order here to me, and I will send it up to Sacramento where they're going to be duplicated. And if you want the reels, the 7-foot reels, 1,800 feet, $5 per show, reel to reel, and I will be keeping a regular table of contents of the program so that you can order the back orders, cassettes, or reels. There's a new book out on the John Kennedy assassination that's supposed to be excellent. I just sent for it. It's called Presumed Guilty. It's $12, but maybe your libraries can get it. It's out by Howard Rothman, a history major, Farley Dickinson University Press. The subject of the book is that the Warren Commission prejudged Oswald guilty and made all the circumstantial evidence bolster its assumption and suppressed or ignored other evidence. It's supposed to be an excellent book. If you're interested, again, if you miss the name of the author and you want it, write to me and I'll send you that information. There just doesn't seem enough time to give the individual addresses of all this material, but if you write and ask me, I can send it back to you. Also, Computer and People, it used to be Computer and Automation, became Computer and People, has its own magazine now. It's going to be called People and the Pursuit of Truth. The subscription is going to be $6, the same address as Computer and Automation, and it will be dedicated entirely to conspiracies and assassinations with contributions from various researchers and information about the various conferences, and this will be in the form of a newsletter filled with information, people, and the pursuit of truth. In the next few weeks, you will be reading a news conference of Richard Popkind, who wrote The Second Oswald. He will be giving out evidence of the William Colby Report of June 28, 1974, to Howard Baker. Many of you who've listened to KLRB the last 3 weeks particularly have listened to details of that report. That was a news first, I believe, in radio broadcasting for KLRB to put on the air this report. You heard it first on KLRB, which is not unusual. You'll be reading about it in the news. This report includes many important things that I will be talking about in the future that I mentioned before, such as the Mr. Edwards file, V. Howard Hunt, that is still in the hands of Mr. Colby, the bigot list of Hunt that's still in the hands of Mr. Colby, the links of Eugenio Martinez to the planned demonstrations in Miami, the San Diego plan that was moved to Miami, and especially the links of Robert Bennett and the used tool company feeding Bob Woodward. That was Deep Throat bringing Richard Nixon out of office. The ITT used people sliding Richard Nixon out of office through the Washington Post. And then these documents reveal the External Employment Assistance Branch, which was lending E. Howard Hunt locksmiths from March to May, and further investigation may probably link up the entry into Arthur Bremer's apartment or J. Edgar Hoover's house. I think the dates are important and the parties involved are important. This three-part interview will be coming out over the news service in the next week or two, but you can say again you heard it on KORV. Another first I will be bringing to you next week on the same program will be parts of the grand jury testimony of E. Howard Hunt before the Watergate Committee or in the Washington investigators. Rather, it was not the Watergate, it was the Washington investigation. I have parts of E. Howard Hunt's grand jury testimony, and there it is confirmed that one particular agent of the Central Intelligence Agency resigned and quit his job in Miami because the plans that were the Gemstone plans included murder, killings, and kidnappings. Now, all of you who are familiar with the Lewis Tackwood allegations made in 1971, the agent provocateur from the Los Angeles Police Department, that at the conventions in San Diego, the Republican conventions, there was going to be kidnapping and massive killings of even congressmen, possibly the President of the United States. And in these documents, you will hear for the first time read on the air next week the allegations of even Mr. E. Howard Hunt telling about a man who backed down because Bernard Barker told him the plans would include killings and kidnappings. And then there will be more I'll be reading you from the grand jury testimony that confirms my allegations of the Bennett company, the tools used tool company, and ITT really all being one, and one meaning Central Intelligence Agency. I want to announce the conference and then present Elmer Davis, who's sitting here with me, because he's going down to the conference at UCLA with me. The Assassination Conspiracy Conference at UCLA is different than the one in Boston, which was on the assassination of John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, the shooting of George Wallace, and the Chappaquiddick drowning of Mary Jo Kopechne. New York University had a conference last week on the assassination of John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy. But there's a new committee in Los Angeles called the Campaign for Democratic Freedoms, which is planning a conference, and I'm going to read in quotes. This is written by Don Fried, who's helping to organize this committee. The conference moves from scrutiny of the political assassinations to the war conspiracy. This includes Jane Fonda, who will be there, and many people who fought the Vietnamese War these many years. It goes from the political assassinations to the war conspiracy to the local level. The local level is what I refer to constantly as Watergate West. It will go into the Los Angeles Police Department's dreaded criminal conspiracy section, and it will go into new evidence to present at the UCLA over the LAPD criminal conspiracy, the involvement in the murder of Jonathan and George Jackson and James Carr, and the attempts on the life of Huey Newton. It will go into the formation and the cover-up of terrorism in California, together with at least three other state and federal agencies. Now this is goes into the area that I talk about, the creation of the Zebra killings, the Zodiac killings, and the SLA inside the prison systems and letting the men out to kill to spread terrorism, or using agents from overseas to spread terrorism. It'll go into the penetration of the entire Southern California criminal justice system by agents of the CIA and the Howard Hughes Organization, suppression of evidence of the assassination of Robert Kennedy by the Los Angeles Police Department under the control of the CIA, the Los Angeles Police Department cooperation with and protection of neo-fascist terrorist attacks in Los Angeles against popular groups such as the Socialist Workers Party or the Rosenberg Committee, and then blackmail dossiers on high-ranking elected officials, including Mayor Tom Bradley, their family and staff, the possession of blackmail files on both reporters and the management of local news media. It will go into the John Kennedy assassination, the Robert Kennedy, but there's going to be an emphasis with movies and documents and various researchers of the links of the Central Intelligence Agency to the local police department, to the California prison system, and link many of these people, the Watergate teams and specific agents, to this massive conspiracy. Incidentally, the first part of the program on Saturday morning, I have a list of the various people there Friday night. But there'll be at 10 o'clock a subject called How to Get Your Dossier, a Freedom of Information Act workshop, headed by Lake Heedley, former police intelligence. Well, I'm very happy to announce that I wrote to the Central Intelligence Agency, and I evidently don't have to take that seminar at 10 o'clock on Saturday morning, because I received a letter this last week that said, "Dear Ms. Brussel, this is in response to your letter of 29th March requesting access to any file the CIA may be maintaining on you. We have made a thorough search of our records and found no information pertaining to you. Sincerely, Robert S. Young, Freedom of Information Coordinator." So all of you who are worried about becoming assassinationologists, as we're termed, or assassination buffs or researchers, you can rest assured that the CIA isn't interested in you, because I've done 11 years research and 4 years on the radio, and I received a letter dated May the 1st, and they don't have anything on the files of Mae Brussel. So you can all rest assured that you'll be safe also, if you can believe that story, right? And you'll find out that you're not included on their files. Well, I have some other material to go into, but I don't want to take too long, because pertinent to the conference in Los Angeles, I have Elmer Davis here, who's been on Dialogue Conspiracy with me before. And some of you don't know who he is, so we'll go again, introduce him to you, and we'll talk about the things that he will be doing with me at the conference in Los Angeles. He'll be attending the press conference. Elmer, how long has it been since you were on Dialogue Conspiracy with me?
Oh, roughly a couple of months, I think it was. I don't remember correctly.
I met Elmer Davis in 1973.
Yes, that's correct.
July 73?
Yes.
You wrote me a letter?
Yes.
And told me you were a scapegoat at the Watergate.
That's true.
Describe what you were doing in the April 73. You were at Folsom Prison. Describe what you were doing when you got entangled in the Pentagon Papers trial. Can you tell us?
Well, that date stands out very vividly in my mind. I was, as it was my usual custom, I was in the law library section of the prison, and I had left on my way to the main yard, and I heard my name called over the squawk box, telling me to report to the captain's office. And so the natural reaction of an inmate incarcerated is to wonder what fraction of the rule has he committed, because ordinarily, when you call to a captain's office, that is the case. So I'm racking my brain trying to recall what misstep I might have made inside. And when I go into the captain's office, there is Lieutenant Buchanan, who tells me that Daniel Ellsberg's investigators want to see me. And as it is in the case of prisons or institutions, you have to sign a waiver. And he asked me, did I want to sign this waiver? And I told him, oh, you must be kidding. You know, you pulling my leg. You jiving. What do I have to do with Daniel Ellsberg? He said, well, I don't know. So they want to see you, want to talk to you concerning the Ellsberg case, I presume. And I was so shocked, and one of the few times in my life I was speechless. So I turned them down, and later that day, some of the other inmates had read in the Sacramento newspaper where B.L. Clark, chief of police of the Beverly Hills Police Department, had said that I had confessed to the break-in and burglary of Dr. Lewis J. Fillon's office at Beverly Hills, who was Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist. So that was the first I heard of my involvement in the Fillon burglary. And yeah, I read it in the newspaper, and Lieutenant Buchanan asked me that I wanted to be interviewed by his investigators.
Yeah, and the consequence of that was, after studying law for was 10 years at the time.
Yes.
You slapped a $2 million lawsuit against Richard Nixon.
That's true.
The White House plumbers, G. Gordon Liddy, E. Howard Hunt, E. Jill Crow, John Ehrlichman. Do you want to talk about your lawsuit, the involvement of where it stands now?
Yes, it's up to this point, it has progressed rather nicely, thanks to you. I had some difficulty in serving the various defendants, as you might well expect. They were all either in and out of court, or they lived in different sections of the nation, and then, too, there was some chicanery on the part of the U.S. Marshal's Office because of their former positions, I imagine.
Remember, they gave you the wrong address for John Ehrlichman, and you had to trace him around the country. I remember the frustration Elmer had when he finally pinned John Ehrlichman down. It was tracing between Washington and Seattle and back and forth and hotels and houses. And the U.S. Marshal had this some of their service. And finally, the day that the sentencing of John, Judge Sirica's office, and you knew the exact office and the time and the court he'd be in. The Marshal's building is just down the hall, I guess, from that
I imagine.
Office, right?
They're usually in the same building, federal building.
So finally, Elmer said, okay, at Friday morning on such and such a date at 9 o'clock, you can give it to him because we know he'll be in that building. He's going to be sentenced. And you got up in the morning and called Washington. They said they'd send the summons back to California.
Yeah, I think it was January the 21st when he was sentenced.
We can laugh now, but it wasn't funny in those days.
No, how we first managed to serve him, locate him, was when I had a brainstorm and sending a complaint and summons by certified mail, and apparently the mailman knew him personally and knew the Ehrlichman family, so he served him, and Mrs. Ehrlichman signed the receipts, and then I was in turn able to have the U.S. Marshal's Office serve him at that location.
Of course, once they were sentenced and put in back in prison, like G. Gordon Liddy, I think the serving of Liddy is interesting. A lot of people who listen to this program would appreciate it after Liddy chased so many persons around in the drug scene in New York, and he was an FBI man, a law and order man. He worked at the Treasury and the Justice Department, worked with the FBI. But when he was in jail, he didn't want to respond to you, did he?
Yes, the U.S. Marshal, in his remarks on the return to the issuance of a summons, he said that he served Liddy in the federal prison at Danbury, Connecticut, but on the first time, he says in the remarks, I hereby certify and return that on the above date, February the 19th, 1975, at Federal Correctional Institution, Danbury, Connecticut, I made one endeavor to serve this summons and complaint, but the within name G. Gordon Liddy would not make himself available to me for said service. Subsequently, as a result of G. Gordon Liddy's failure to report to the warden's office, as ordered, he was placed in administrative detention, which is, in the vernacular of the prison, the hold. At 10:23 hours, in the company of Lieutenant Williams, I entered the first tier of the administrative detention, and I located G. Gordon Liddy in cell C thereat. I identified myself and stated that I had a summons and complaint to be served on him and asked would he accept in-hand service. G. Gordon Liddy ignored my presence and refused by his actions to accept in-hand service. At this time, I left the summons and complaint folded between the bars of his cell.
That's pretty good.
This is indicative of his attitude throughout the entire Watergate proceedings and his failure to give testimony, and throughout this particular case, he has failed to answer interrogatories or respond in any fashion to the complaint, and so I have filed for a default of judgment, which is to be heard on the 20th of this month, and I look forward to favorable decision because he hadn't cooperated in any respect, and he's shown an outright contempt for the court process.
If you win this case, it will set a precedent for a lot of other people to sue these particular persons.
Well, that's one of the main reasons that I've sued. I think it's an outrage for defendants representing the higher echelon of governments to reach down in the bottom of the barrel to pick out a victim of a minority race and with no standing, so to speak, to victimize him, innocent victim, I might add, you know. And so I feel that if the court should rule favorably in my case, it would have precedential value. It would be a precedent of sort. Plus, it would serve as a warning to people of their ilk, police department, so forth, that they can't just randomly pick someone up off the street and charge him with 35-odd burglaries and a scandalous crime like the Dr. Fielden burglary without making some type of retribution.
Yeah, Elmer's background was that he was in Beverly Hills, and he was in a shop and was picked up and charged with a burglary in that shop, and then he was taken to the police department, and it seems that it was a very feeble excuse to pick him up, and there wasn't anything on him. It was like $20 was found in the office later. It wasn't on his person. There was no link of him to the money that had been temporarily missing that was found. But once he was taken from this Elizabeth Arden shop to the police department, the detectives there said that they had 35 burglaries in the area that were unsolved, and they were very anxious to solve them and asked him if he would do them a favor and help clean the books, and which he didn't accept at all, and then went to jail on that one charge and later had a parole violated because of the long list of charges, which they added on, even though he didn't agree to that. And one of those burglaries that he claimed he hadn't done any of them, but the most famous of the goodness knows what the 34 other were. Wouldn't you like to see the list? One of Dr. Lewis Fielding?
I would. But this was the cover to include the Dr. Fielding.
To cover it, yes.
Burglary into it at their convenience.
Well, this is what is so important about that UCLA conference, too, that they're going into. It's the first conference of national and state where they're going into the use of the local police department to cover the crimes of the Central Intelligence Agency. Each one of these things will eventually lead you even to who killed John Kennedy. You know, if you put the pieces together like I've done, they're terribly important. I think Elmer's case is very important. I was glad that he made the introduction to me in 73, and I've been very close to the case. As a matter of fact, Elmer has here his interrogatories, questions that he has asked. Here's a sample from the chief of police in Beverly Hills. There's several questions that you ask in advance of going into the court. Read these questions because I think they describe so perfectly the work of B.L. Cork. I might say that I was raised in Beverly Hills, California, and was always told they had one of the best police departments in the world. So this question that Elmer asked and the response is from the chief of police in Beverly Hills.
This is interrogatory number 63 of the interrogatory that I propounded and submitted to the chief of police of Beverly Hills, B.L. Clark. I asked him, did you call for an extensive investigation as to the burglary the plaintiff Elmer Davis allegedly admitted to subsequent to said admission? And his response to said interrogatory was no. The following question, if your answer to interrogatory number 63 is in the negative, explain why no such investigation was called for. If your answer to interrogatory number 63 is in the affirmative, give the name of the parties who participated in the investigation of said matter subsequent to the plaintiff's alleged admission. This was his response to that interrogatory. As the plaintiff admitted to the entry into the building, and as he was not charged with the crime, no investigation appeared to be necessary.
Let me just ask you one thing here before we go to the next question. The chief of police, B.L. Cork, is saying, being as you admitted it and you were not charged with it, They didn't have to investigate it. This is the office of Daniel Ellsberg, psychiatrist at the White House. Plumbers later admitted they did. Isn't that a little unusual that, say, a person in Beverly Hills is charged or admits that he did a burglary of a doctor's office on Bedford Drive, and that when he admits it, he's never charged, and therefore they don't investigate it?
It's ridiculous. It has no legal or factual foundation. As you know, I have about 11 years experience as a law researcher, about the equal number of years you've had in your field. And when a person confesses to a crime, it's the same as if a jury finds him guilty. He's pleading guilty to every element of the crime, and so there's nothing left but the filing of the charge. And
then they file a charge. They just let it go. If somebody says, well, this drugstore is burglarized, and another person says, well, I confess I did it, and then they say, then it's dropped.
Oh,
is that ever done?
This is one of the features of the case that points up to the fact that the police chief had told an outright lie. He committed an act of perjury. If I had confessed to a crime,
then he would have charged him.
Especially a crime of that nature involving Daniel Ellsberg, psychiatrist, surely they would have prosecuted me for it, filed charges against me and prosecuted me for it. He wouldn't have let it go. If necessary, he would have made some post-confession investigation.
This is like racism in reverse. When you're on the streets of Beverly Hills, they pick you up when you haven't done a crime and charge you. But when it's convenient to cover the White House, they say, well, we'll let you off, as if they really are so lenient. We won't charge you with this crime. We'll just put your name on the book to clear it, you know.
Another interesting feature of the case that will point up the perjury aspect of it is the fact that one of the three Cubans that participated in the burglary of the office of Dr. Louis J. Fillon on the 3rd of September 1971, a Eugenio Martinez, confessed that upon entering the office of Dr. Fillon, looking for these files on Daniel Ellsberg, that they spread vitamin C pills over the floor to give it appearance that a drug addict had committed his offense. So come 1973, B.L. Clark, the chief of police, he conveniently said that I confessed to the crime and said I was a narcotic addict looking for drugs to fit in with
vitamin C in a psychiatrist's
this cover-up office. Story of the government.
Yeah, so he had
vitamin C, and any person with that type of background, no, a drug addict wouldn't.
He wouldn't go around confessing. I'm an.
No.
Besides the fact that you hadn't had narcotics in '66, so they picked a scapegoat, but they hadn't kept track of you since.
What they did was to. They picked an ideal scapegoat. A former narcotic addict, black, had a previous criminal record and unconnected, so to speak, don't know nobody. So they felt, I assume, that who would take his word against chief of police of Beverly Hills? In his interrogatory, he said he had worked in Beverly Hills 21 years. But this is typical, I might add, too. This is typical. There's so many people in jail, in prison, under this present system
of justice.
For the identical reason. Some policeman said, well, he did it. They attempting to clean up the books and make themselves look good for political reasons, for self-aggrandizing.
Good cop, they solved the crime.
Yeah. Yet a person goes to prison and he can't prove it. He said, well, you have, the police officer said you confessed, or the police officer said he saw you.
Yeah, that's the end of it. Yeah. Well, there's another part of that interrogatory which was good, another question here you asked.
Interrogatory number 64 is quite interesting. It said, as the plaintiff admitted to the entry into the building, and that he was not charged with a crime, no investigation appeared to be necessary. That's the one I just read a moment ago. The one following it was, well, there, Captain Rutherford, employed with the Beverly Hills Police Department in Beverly Hills, California, in the latter part of the year 1971, the first part of 1971, and The response to that was yes. If your answer to interrogatory number 65 is in the affirmative, does your record indicate that the plaintiff did write a letter to same complaining that defendants named Harry N. W. L. Franklin, detective, and Bruce Campbell, detective of the Beverly Hills Police Department, Beverly Hills, California, did commit perjury, suborn perjury, and falsify evidence, among other things, and bring about the plaintiff's conviction in the Elizabeth Arden's matter? No. Now, this is... In 1971, I was arrested about a month after the Dr. Fielding's burglary. So this was the preliminary step in
framing
me for the Dr. Fielding's burglary.
In 71, you wrote to Captain Rutherford and complained that these arresting officers were falsifying evidence and committing perjury. And then after the Watergate came and the Ellsberg thing came, you proved to be right that they were falsifying stuff against you. And then the record showed that you were right and that you had complained. If you had actually confessed to this particular burglary, then why would you write a letter complaining that they're falsifying evidence against you?
Well, I had called L.A. Free Press, the Times. I had written letters to a certain police board set up within the L.A. PD organization that's supposedly was set up to investigate that type of complaint, and Captain Rutherford, because it was a desperate situation. I knew that
I was being... You knew there was some political overtones, or what?
I knew. I suspected because they were so set on me confessing, and when I refused, they manufactured evidence, committed perjury, suborned perjury, that is, encouraged others to commit perjury, and all to get a conviction. And unfortunately, due to my experience in the area of law, I had this alleged confession unsigned and no mention of Dr. Fielding in it, introduced into the evidence of that trial.
It's good that you represented yourself there.
So, yes, I'm looking forward. I didn't know when it would happen, but I had the faith that this type of thing would eventually be discovered. So, in 1973, when Ellsberg's investigator, defense team, went to Los Angeles County Jail and saw my probation report indicating that I had been in jail at the time during the Labor Day weekend, doing serving 10 days, so I couldn't possibly have committed the crime.
So everything was...
And they also checked and saw where I had written a letter to Captain Rutherford of the Beverly Hills Police Department complaining about his officers committing this act.
So this $2 million lawsuit you have really, I think, looks good, don't you? Because you had, in your trial, you accused them of falsifying evidence. And then later it turns out that they were pushing this on you. And they went ahead and put the name down anyway when you wouldn't confess to cover for the White House CIA, always keeping in mind that... Elmer calls himself the Watergate scapegoat. He was to cover for the White House, the FBI, gentlemen G. Gordon Liddy, the CIA man E. Howard Hunt, Richard Nixon ordering this operation. The defendants in this lawsuit were former President Richard Nixon. We'll discuss that. And E. Howard Hunt, G. Gordon Liddy, Egil Crow, who really set up the plumbers operation, John Ehrlichman, and Mr. Cork, Chief of Police of Beverly Hills, and Detectives Franklin and Campbell.
Bruce Campbell and W.L. Franklin.
And I get B.L. Cork, those letters mixed around sometimes. Richard Nixon is not part of the lawsuit now anymore, except in title. It does read Davis versus Nixon. I was down with Elmer in Los Angeles when the attorney for Richard Nixon stood up next to him. That was a good moment, don't you think, in the case when the magistrate turned down the request of the former president, his attorney stood up next to Elmer.
Up to this point, United States Magistrate Ralph J. Geffen has been very fair in the matter. I think, I don't want to overspeak myself, but I think he's one of the more liberal ones on the bench, but in any event, it was a good decision. As far as it went, but I disagree, although the law is against me, that the president has sovereign immunity, and he's not amenable to the law for any acts he commit while in office. And this has been the law since the first Supreme Court of the United States said, and I think the leading case is Marbury versus Madison. But under the democratic system of government, I personally feel that no one should be above the law. And I sued with the hope that I would be proven right in this regard. And I saw a trend set where there might have been a possibility that former President Richard M. Nixon would be impeached. So this, among other reasons, is why I sued. But unfortunately, our present president, Gerald Ford, granted him, I think prematurely, granted him a pardon even before he was accused of any charges, and I think that's a bad precedent for the country.
Well, I think he, personally, knowing the Ford's involvement in the Kennedy assassination and the cover-up of the Kennedy assassination and the fact that Oswald did not fire a gun or own a gun, that many of the researchers know the impossibility of the ballistics and so forth. When you think that Gerald Ford was on the Warren Commission and that this investigation of Watergate's going to go all the way back to Dallas. I brought an article from the New York Times. We can go into it briefly. It's a new article, said the Rockefeller Commission has been forced to add it to the agenda. The assassination is a subject that just won't go away. Domestic and foreign. This was Sunday New York Times, May the 4th. And the fact that Gerald Ford was on the Warren Commission, he gives immunity to Richard Nixon because his time may come where people demand documents and the truth from him, and he'd be, I think he should be impeached right now for the
It's no doubt. I personally think it's just another step in a giant conspiracy to whitewash the many acts such as assassination.
But he could identify by giving immunity to Nixon because someday he may need it himself, and they'd say the press that is here. So if things get too hot, he could just step down the end of the year and never be charged with cover-up of a giant series of conspiracies which we researchers are putting together. What's he going to do? There's a conference, I say, in Boston and then the one in New York, but the most important is the thing, I think, in California, which links to your life and to men in the prisons and people on the streets who are victims of terrorism, or the Department of Corrections conspiracy that links the CIA, which was your problem, the way that it linked to you.
This is the thing a lot of people don't realize. I've experienced some rather unsettling experiences in my lifetime, but this, to me, in spite of my sophistication in that regard, was one of the most outrageous things that I've ever experienced. To think that I could be singled out, to use the term Rutho used, what was that? I was
the throwaway people.
Throwaway.
Yeah, one of the defendants.
Just like one of these cans, you know, disposable throwaway type of individual, and they didn't place no value on my life or freedom at all.
Well, this is the important thing. Anthony Russo was a defendant with Daniel Ellsberg in the Pentagon Papers trial, and he gave a speech, or maybe he's given many, and he referred to Elmer as one of the throwaway people because you were brought in on charges that were later dropped that had no basis in fact, and you're out on parole. And then they look at your record, and here's these 35 burglaries in Beverly Hills, and they say, well, this is a lot of recidivism. Maybe he's not a good risk. Maybe we should just put him back in Folsom and add, what was it, 6 months to 15 years. And there you were sitting. It was 3 years, and you were sitting there and pulled back, your parole violated, a long list of charges, and you tell me it's a common thing for the police department to say to people, clean this up.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it has. Your case has so many implications that I'm writing about. My next article for The Realist, the long article, will be about Elmer Davis, and then we want to do a book together. But it has so many ramifications. I think that if a person is in prison and his time comes up for a new trial or hearing, and they find that some charge is on his record that he never knew about, I think he should be let out of jail immediately. I don't really think that they should keep him one day longer. They took a year, you know, before you got out. But he should be told exactly what he's in there for instead of saying, will you plead guilty to all these things?
That's the slowest process I know of. They have a legal expression just as slow but sure, but there's many a person wasting his life away in prison waiting for this fig leaf turn of event justice to come about, and it shouldn't be that way.
This program does reach a persons in Soledad Prison, Folsom, and Vacaville, and Tracy, and then through the grapevine, they send messages to friends at Tehachapi and Chino and San Luis Obispo. And maybe they could think now, because there is this new campaign for democratic freedoms and an organizing committee down in Los Angeles that's going into these things, maybe people who are in prison who know that they've been charged with a long list of, you didn't even know your name was on them.
Oh.
If these men have been charged with a long list of crimes, or if they agree, that they find out later that they have this list on their record they didn't know about, they would maybe send a letter to me and we'd put them in a file and send them this committee and maybe get some investigators working on those cases and break open this practice, which is common, of adding a long list of charges to somebody's record.
I would like to add a comment to that. I would like the fellows inside and all of those who have been victimized, such as I and many others, take heart in the fact that I am pursuing this matter to represent the interests of one and all of us, you know, hopefully that the courts and all will vindicate us. And like you say, those who have been made victims, such as I and others,
Should write in and let us know if your name has been put on a long list. You know, there's a problem I read about in the paper this week, and it's so unsolvable. It seems like there must be some solutions to these things. They're very difficult. Like, there's a question of the White Panthers and the Haight-Ashbury, and they were told if you plead guilty to these charges, we'll let you off completely. And they felt that the jury and the judge would allow them to explain why they had shot a policeman, that if they had wanted to kill a policeman, they were excellent marksmen, why they shot over the heads, what they were doing, and they were not allowed to explain. Then they were given 10 years each, two men, in sentence to jail. Now, just from a dollars and cents tax point from the taxpayer, and then you go into the human lives, because mostly the people at large only understand money. Imagine housing 20 years, 10 years each, two gentlemen, where the prosecutors were willing to let them go free if they plead guilty. There must be some common arrangement, like they make a deal, and we know these things happen, or with you, you don't make a deal, so it's on your record. You've been inside, now you're outside. What is the best way to go about changing these kind of situations where it's either added on your name and you don't know it?
They've gotten is two recent decisions, Menard versus Mitchell and Menard versus Saxby, that was decided in Washington, D.C., where the person, if he has been arrested and found innocent, then he can file certain papers in the courts and they have erase, for whatever purpose,
the
erase
plea of guilty.
Race charges off his record, you know. If he's never been filed again, say, and there was no probable cause for arrest, but when he's pleaded guilty, he has to go through a long, drawn-out court process to vindicate himself. So this is what is disencouraging, because most people don't have the money to hire an attorney, or he doesn't know the law. Fortunately, I studied the law, and it benefited me to that extent.
It's a wonderful fluke of history that Elmer Davis was busy. He traded narcotics for law in 1966 and studied law diligently and is carrying on his case. He is doing a mammoth job filing against seven defendants all by himself, and we do not have any formal defense fund. He could use contributions from a defense fund. This is a big historic case, a landmark case. And any money that you want to send towards his fund or organizing, if you get interested and want to spread information about the case going to trial, he can use assistance for copying paper and typing and postage. It's already been terribly expensive, and we're doing the best we can. He's pursuing it, and he's doing all his own law work, which is a mammoth job. Well, Elmer goes down to Los Angeles May 20th for another hearing, and we'll keep you posted on the case of May 20th. We'll keep you posted. Elmer's saying name. What name, Elmer?
Name and address.
Oh, May Brussel. Send it to May Brussel at KLRB. and I'll give it to Elmer Davis, Box 3904 in Carmel, California. This is time for us to close Dialogue Conspiracy. We'll see you next week, and I'll report on the conference in Los Angeles and also some of the E. Howard Hunt grand jury testimony.
This has been Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for 10 years has been researching the facts behind political assassinations and conspiracies in this country. Dialogue Conspiracy originates with KELRB-FM in Carmel, California.